She reached the Café Glockenspiel on Hermannstrasse at 7:30, said good morning to Herr Klinker, asked as she always did after his mother upstairs, inquired of Frau Klupfel if her back felt any better today, and received a gruff reply. And as always, she smiled to cheer her up, and as always, it failed to work. She changed into her overall, tidied her hair in the glass, looked at her eyes, her mouth, saw the image there of her mother, who was still living where they were living then, in the East. Now the country was reunified, but in name only. Anyway, she thought as she turned away from the mirror and picked up her mop, it's the spirit of the age for countries to be disintegrating, so why should Germany be an exception? She was good at swabbing out the café. When she'd first come to Berlin in the new year, and her hours were different, she'd had to do it last thing at night. But Frau Klinker upstairs had complained about the clatter of the tin pail on the floor. A plastic bucket didn't have a mop rinse, so the business was now left until the morning. Slopping away, she would think every morning without fail of her father. How he used to do the same thing in the school where they eventually sent him to do menial work. An under-janitor, just to insult him more. And every morning she would feel the same intense rage, have to fight to hold it down, hold it down. She's in her pinafore, standing behind the counter, when the first of the customers come in. Most are regulars of the Glockenspiel. A few are pedestrians or motorists who've lost their way about this corner of Berlin. At 11 or 12 minutes past 10, depending on whether the lights at the intersection crossing have been at red or green, he pushes open the door and walks in, and her heart jumps. Herr Schreier, as her boss insists she should call him, even when she's talking about him in the kitchen. It's an 11 or 12 minute walk to the Glockenspiel from his house, and of course she knows precisely where he lives. That was her first task after she arrived in the city, visiting her contacts to get the addresses of those former state officials now living in the West, residents here with their old names but doctored CVs and conveniently selective memories. He's fit for a 50-year-old. He has the orderliness of a police officer still, movements like clockwork, polished shoes, a clean shirt and tie, attaché case from which he extracts a neatly folded newspaper to read with his coffee. The hair at the back of his head always ends in a clean, straight line on the neck. Maybe his wife attends to that. But she has seen Frau Schreier, with her new Western clothes and hairstyle, and her brisk Berliner's ways, and her new youth, and doubts if she'll be so obliging now. This morning she serves him coffee, just as usual, gives him the same tight, business-like smile, and stands back against the wall to study him. He sits, as ever, side on to her, in the middle of the room, with his back to the window, but able to view the life on the street. An old trick, this, in the gilded panel of mirror on the wall. She watches him in turn, scarcely takes her eyes off him, wonders, as always, how she can bring herself to be so calm when the man she hates most in the world, most wants to see dead, is here, in the same room with her, only 6 or 7 meters away at most. Her father had made documentary films. To be allowed to work on his own more poetic sort that won prizes in the West, he used to have to accompany official delegations to trade fairs around the world, filming politely smiling faces and handshakes and contract signings. After a visit to Melbourne, where something happened, he disappeared, telling his minders later only that he'd gone off for 24 hours to look about him, which they didn't believe. Following that, he was refused any more overseas trips. Grounding meant having to act as cameraman, not director, filming the production line at a factory, or work on a new autobahn, or the organised sports at a party worker's summer camp. He hated that, and no longer having the resources for his own films. If they hadn't confined him, maybe he would have kept better company. So his prosecutors were to accuse him, and not associated with the dangerous dissident types they already had under observation. Someone must have tipped them off. A false friend. And that was the start of it. The Stasi bully boys ringing the doorbell at home and calling her father to account. And now here he sits, his chief interrogator, Schreier. For 2 years, ever since she set out west, she has planned what to do, whatever the circumstance of the Café Glockenspiel, which is her cover, permits her. Tips scalding coffee onto his head. Hold the match for him when he lights the first or second of his 2 cigarettes, and then push the flame into his eye. Slit his throat with the taut knife, or stab him in the back of the neck where the skin is bare, or else deep into his chest, right over the heart. Then, of course, she'll reconsider. About how to be more subtle. Poison in his coffee, either in one go, or over a period of days, weeks. If she could only ask for advice from him, with his knowledge of all the sinister means of revenge at a state's disposal. Sometimes Herr Klinker coming through makes her jump, and she has to start collecting the cups and saucers from the other tables, straightening the chairs. It's Frau Klupfel she has to beware of, though. Frau Klupfel has harsh words for the immigrants, whatever the colour of their skin. So far as Frau Klupfel is concerned, after 3 months she's still here on probation at the Glockenspiel. Frau Klupfel has caught her staring at Schreier, and maybe she thinks she wants to steal the contents of the man's briefcase, or his watch. It's a gold watch, with a gold strap. Her father's Swiss watch was one of the first items they'd had to pawn, and after that they'd had to rely for the time on the radio, until that was pawned too. After that, there were the public clocks, on towers and street corners, some fast and some slow, and you had to remember just which. Even so, she'd had a punctual girlhood, because her mother was determined that standards shouldn't slip. Even at the end, when her father was being taken away every few weeks and detained for questioning, there had to be standards. Now she has a watch of her own. A cheap plastic quartz wristwatch which tells perfect time. But other than getting herself to work by 7:30 sharp, and getting herself as composed as she can for Schreier's entrance at 11 or 12 minutes past 10, time is immaterial to her. She lives on different levels of time. Here in Berlin, simultaneously with her mother in the smoky city over the horizon, with both her parents during the happy times when they were always together and her father laughed and played with her, and later when he seemed to forget how to, and later again after the accident, so-called, when there were just herself and her mother left. One cup of black coffee, always one, one lump of sugar unwrapped slowly from the paper, and 2 cigarettes. He reads his newspaper. He looks very respectable, like a lawyer or a banker. That's the cleverness. He doesn't suspect her, she feels sure, but he's perpetually on alert. He's primed, just as he always knew back then to watch his back. In the old days, her father would take cinefilm pictures of their holidays, their picnics, summer afternoons in the garden when they had a proper house, toboggan runs in the snow. The police didn't find all the films. But the projector had to go into hock, so she only has her memories. Everything exists in her memory. There's nothing else. Not now. A car breaks in the street, squeals on the tarmac adam, another car behind slams on its brakes. She stares out. They told them her father was knocked down on his way back to them. A traffic accident, although the car hadn't stopped. Her mother was taken to identify the body, mangled by the fast wheels. An accident was impossible to prove or disprove. Usually he was driven back and dropped off at the end of their street, pushed out of the car onto the pavement. It was an opportune death for them. They had got out of him all that they could, but they couldn't let him have his old way of life back again. Once things like watches and cine projectors went into hock, they remained there for their sort, staying eternally out of circulation. A hot tear drops onto the back of her hand. Quite calmly, she picks up the knife she uses to slice the cakes with. She places it inside her magazine. She walks across the room. Schreier is still reading his newspaper, but he has a sixth sense for danger, and she thinks she sees his shoulders stiffen. She's still half a dozen steps away from him. She doesn't stop, though. She tightens her fingers on the handle of the knife concealed inside the magazine. But before she can reach him, lunge at him, there's a shrill tap on the window. Urgent tapping with knuckles against the glass. A teenage girl is knocking to get someone's attention. Schreier springs to his feet, opens his hand in a wave. With the other hand, he snatches up his newspaper and briefcase. The girl is at the door. It's his daughter. She kisses her father on one cheek, and as she does so, looks directly to where she is standing, clutching the magazine. The girl has big, sad eyes. They're red, as if she has been crying. She's unhappy, and at 14 or 15 years old, she is also innocent, just. The eyes seem to be imploring her, for clemency. She found she was still standing there after they'd gone. In his haste to go, he dropped his wallet. She bent down to retrieve it, holding on to the magazine and knife all the while. She slipped the wallet into the pocket of her pinafore. Just out of the corner of her eye, in the gilt-framed mirror, she thought she saw Frau Klupfel's eyes moving off her from behind the counter, but she couldn't be sure about it. She has to stay calm. She has to defy them all. In the toilet, she counts nearly 1,000 marks. Of course, Schreier must have ready access to money. The old junta was always moving funds out, just in case. In the afternoon, she has to act out her role, but she knows it's for the last time. As she always did, she got the tram heading home from the stop outside the optician shop. As always, the tram glided on its steel tracks. Old leaves blew, spiralled on the cobblestones. Looking among the reflections in the window glass, she imagined she caught the girl's big red eyes looking back into hers, transmitting their sadness and relief. And behind them a changed world passes. Advertising hoardings and neon and mirror-faced office buildings. Today she doesn't get off at her own stop. She stays on the tram. She travels on. Into the next street. And the next. And the next. On the moving billboards the advertisements rotate. From cars to underwear. From mobile telephones to summer holidays to fridge freezers. She checks that the 1,000 marks is still safely in her pocket. Auf Wiedersehen, Glockenspiel. She will return to her mother, East, try to settle down again, or maybe find them another flat not too far away, get a job if she can. She'll try to earn enough to hire a projector, so she can run the spools of cinefilm they were able to hide. Copies of her father's documentary films exist, in the backs of dark cupboards somewhere, in friends' and colleagues' basements. But first she has to track them down, before she can bring all their lost lives back into the light.
Becky Hindley was reading The Waitress at the Glockenspiel by Ronald Frame. The producer was David Hunter.